Sometimes he wasn't.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right.
Sometimes he isn't. Sometimes.
Hearing of the House and Senate Judiciary Committee, and I just introduce everybody for the witnesses. I'm Jerry Gardner, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, and on my left is Senator George Holman, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and many other titles. I'd like to introduce on this side of the table Representative Larry Carpenter, Representative Ed Dankworth, Representative Fred Brown, Representative Bill Miles, and Representative Dick Elias, and members of the House Judiciary Committee.
With me representing the Senate Judiciary Committee is Senator Pat Rohde, who's also chairman of the Code Revision Commission.
Okay, and I guess we'll, and also we have Representative Lisa Rudd, who's just come into the room, also a member of the House Judiciary Committee. And we have several people that testify today. The first one we'd like to hear from as Mr. Dan Hickey, representing the Department of Law and the Administration. If you'd testify in the end chair here, be the best down at this end of the table.
Chairman Gardner, Chairman Homan, members of the Combined House and Senate Judiciary Committees. My name is Dan Hickey. I'm the Chief Prosecutor for the State of Alaska, and I was a member of the Criminal Code Revision Subcommission, along with Senator Rohde and Representative Gardner, who co-chaired that group. I think most of the members of the committees are probably familiar with the history of efforts in Alaska to revise the Criminal Code over the last probably 10 years. There have been very few legislative sessions that have gone by where some bill has not been pending before the legislature suggesting a comprehensive revision to the criminal laws of Alaska. In the past, none of those bills have really met with any success because of their length of necessity and because of the general feeling, in my judgment, perceived throughout the course of their consideration that they didn't bring to bear in their preparation a consensus of opinion that cut through the criminal justice community and involved public representation in the preparation of those bills. The bill that you now have before you, which I have only in the House version, is House Bill 661. I believe there is a Senate counterpart to that bill, but I don't know the number at this time. That bill, I believe, does contain, in general terms, that consensus. It has been carefully worked on since now July of 1975, was completed in December of last year by a working group composed of representatives of all components of the justice system, along with representation from the public itself. I'd like to, before going into certain provisions of the bill, which I would like to comment on, like to briefly address myself to the need for a revision of our criminal laws and at the same time the objectives which I believe House Bill 661 accomplish. As an initial matter, scattered throughout the statutes that address themselves to criminal offenses in our code, there are a number of outdated and antiquated statutes that contain language that is simply no longer relevant to a modern day society. Examples of such statutes are assault while armed, which pertains to assaults with cowhides, whips, daggers, dirks, etc. Driving animals from a range, which was derived from 19th century Oregon statutes. Dueling, posting another for not engaging in a duel. A secondary objective of the code revision, which goes hand in hand with that, in my judgment, is also the elimination of what has grown to be a proliferation of overly specific statutes that are found throughout the code that have the overall effect of not putting an individual citizen on notice as to what kind of conduct in a given situation on his part might be prescribed by the law. Examples of those statutes are things like obstructing or injuring a railroad or aircraft, a physician administering poison or doing act resulting in death while intoxicated, poisoning itself, larceny of animals, larceny of minerals, embezzlement by an employee, embezzlement by a bailee, embezzlement of public money, embezzlement by a trustee, embezzlement by a fiduciary, fraudulently producing an heir, unauthorized use of a badge, an emblem of a society such as the American Legion, injury to buildings, fences, growing things, and produce, injury to boundary monuments, light posts, protective railings, state-erected signs or historical monuments, injuries to highways, public recreation facilities or highway signs, injuries to trees, or removing timber or minerals from land, trespass itself, trespass on improved land, trespass on mineral claims, and other statutes such as things pertaining to what in the past a past legislature in its infinite wisdom has seen fit to define as objectionable comic books. Virtually all of these statutes are at the same time also covered by more general traditional provisions in the criminal law. These are all examples of statutes that virtually have no meaning in modern day life in this state. They are never charged, and they are all covered by other provisions of the law. The effect, however, of all of these overly specific statutes that are found throughout our criminal laws is, I think, threefold. First, it unnecessarily clutters up the criminal law with meaningless provisions that are never relied on, never utilized, and tend to confuse anyone who's not trained in the law who wants to look at the statutes and see what the criminal law of this state is. More importantly, however, they create a situation where similar conduct, and at times identical conduct, might fall within the coverage of any of a number of statutes that have any of a variety of potential penalties. So a person, for example, could commit an offense and be charged with, at times, as many as 10 or 11 separate crimes that have 10 or 11 separate statutorily authorized penalties. And there are simply no guidelines throughout the statutes for instructing courts or prosecutors as to how to charge and proceed on conduct of that nature. Generally, the law simply relies on the good judgment of people who perform those types of functions and in making charging decisions. A good example, I think, of the kind of situation that having this broad range of overly specific statutes gives rise to, where a range of offenses can be involving similar conduct give rise to a range of varying penalties, is, I think, for example, the offense of shoplifting. An individual who is arrested for removing a pack of chewing gum from a drugstore could be charged with at least three separate offenses. One would be the offense of concealment of merchandise, which currently carries a maximum penalty of 6 months imprisonment. The second would be the offense of petty larceny, which currently is defined as the theft of anything with a value less than $250. That contains a maximum penalty of 1 year. On the other hand, that person could also be charged technically with the offense of larceny in a building, which is a felony that carries a maximum potential penalty of 7 years in prison. And that whole scenario is, in my judgment, a problem that this code addresses and takes care of. Another serious problem that exists in our criminal law at this time is the lack of a coherent penalty structure running throughout the statutes, even as applied to offenses that are utilized and do make sense and should be on the books. There are any of a number of unreasonable and irrational disparities between statutorily authorized sentences that you can find throughout Title 11 that represent this problem. A good example is the legislature finally recently enacted a couple of years ago the offense of aggravated assault, which we never had in this jurisdiction. In other words, a felony level assault where a weapon is not involved but where serious bodily injury results. That offense carries a maximum penalty of 5 years. Forgery of a bill of lading in the course of a commercial transaction, on the other hand, carries a maximum potential sentence of 20 years. I think everyone in this room will agree that an aggravated assault involving serious physical injury as defined in that statute against a person involves a significantly more serious offense than the forging of a bill of lading in a commercial transaction. Theft offenses themselves, for example, have been amended piecemeal over the years from time to time to where we have a situation right now where if an individual steals money or other non-specific property that has a value in excess of $250 and is charged with grand larceny if it's in excess and petty larceny if it's not, one is a felony, one is a misdemeanor. If he's an embezzler, on the other hand, in other words, he stands in one of these peculiar relationships as defined in one of the earlier statutes that I listed, as a bailee, as a public employee, as a fiduciary, as a trustee, etc., the statutory cutoff is $100. So a theft in an embezzlement situation gives rise to a felony offense at an entirely different level than it does in a technical larceny situation. It's also true of forgery. It was until recently true of receiving and concealing stolen property, which was taken care of last year. Plus, we still have a few offenses left in the code that go back to the $50 cutoff. Larceny of an animal, for example. So if you steal an animal and the value of the animal is in excess of $50, that's a felony, technically. This is, in my judgment, another serious problem that House Bill 661 addresses and resolves. But probably from a prosecutorial perspective, the singularly most serious problem throughout the code that House Bill 661 does address itself to is the existence of a absolutely bewildering variety of mental states throughout the code. Mental states which define the crime itself, the mental state which a defendant has to have in committing a crime and which the government has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt in order to convict him. Murder, for example, requires an intent to kill. It does under present law, and it does under proposed bill, House Bill 661. Intentionally is an example of a mental state that everyone familiar with the criminal law understands. On the other hand, in existing law, there are at least 20 mental states that now appear in existing statutes, some of which have been construed by courts to be identical with others, at least in certain contexts. Examples of those were set out in the first tentative draft that came out last year of the code, and they include mental states that are attached to conduct defining a criminal offense, such as knowingly, surreptitiously, maliciously, purposely and deliberately, willfully and wrongfully, maliciously or wantonly, and willfully and deliberately. And I submit to you that with that kind of a proliferation of elements defining crimes, there is no way that a citizen can pick up a section of the Alaska statutes and make any sense out of them and determine what kind of conduct on his part might or might not be prescribed. The code, as I mentioned, eliminates this ambiguity in description of offenses, and in particular, it eliminates the ambiguity that attaches to the use of these mental states, which, as a matter of with respect to certain offenses, as a matter of constitutional law, certain kinds of mental states are required in defining crimes. The code sets forth four basic mental states: intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, and with criminal negligence. And it defines them with particularity, and it uses them with respect to every crime that's defined in the code. Additionally, the proposed revised code. Serves to plug a number of loopholes or omissions in existing law, which have also been created by the fact that the statutes, through a piecemeal adoption approach, have become grossly overspecific. For example, we have at least three separate statutes dealing with various offenses pertaining to false reports to public officials or false reports of an event. They can be found, for example, at AS 1132.15, 1145.050, and 1145.055. And they prohibit false reports of crimes to police officers, false reports of fires by pulling a fire alarm box on a public street corner when there is, in fact, no fire, and a false report of the need for an ambulance, respectively. But they do not, for example, and there's no statute anywhere, that prohibits the false report of any other kind of an emergency to, for example, a police department. There are a number of examples throughout the code that are like that as a result of responding to individual specific problems over a period of time, piecemeal statutes have been created that have never been consolidated, and there are simply, by definition, omissions. There is conduct that I think, again, everyone in this room would agree should be covered under the criminal law, but is not covered. There is not an offense for which it can be charged. To summarize these preliminary remarks, in my judgment, the primary objectives which have been accomplished by the careful drafting of this bill are really the following. First, the elimination of a number of structural defects in existing criminal law in this state. Secondly, the codification in one place of the criminal law of the state in a more rational and coherent fashion. If House Bill 661 is enacted into law, it will mean that everyone associated with the criminal law, and more importantly, the public itself, can find in one place a statement of what the criminal law of this state is, without resorting to decisional law, interpreting provisions that have been entered over a period of time by our Supreme Court and by other appellate courts. Much of what is set forth in House Bill 661 can now only be discovered by examining those decisions. Most importantly, in my judgment, the proposed revised criminal code will simply make the criminal law a good deal easier to understand, and again, more accessible to everyone who comes in contact with it: judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, police officers, correctional officers, and most importantly, again, the general public. Now, I think that there are some certain basic things that need to be recognized in general terms in considering enacting this bill. There's no question, for example, that the bill is going to require a period of time to allow for the development and implementation of a comprehensive program of education and training for again, judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, police officers, and correctional officers. It's going to require the development of model complaints, model indictment forms, sample jury instructions, and the like. I noticed that the effective date clause is proposed to be July 1, 1979. The experiences I but I'm not sure that Alaska is comparable with other jurisdictions in this respect, because I think that in a number of other jurisdictions that have revised their law, that in those efforts, the existence of a law school in that jurisdiction has been of considerable benefit in getting that process of education and training moving. And of course, we don't have that in this state, and that's why I would urge consideration of perhaps an extra 6 months there. I would also urge, because of the experience with the revision subcommission, that consideration be given to either reconstituting it or initiating a new subcommission to deal with Title 12, the Code of Criminal Procedure, and Title 33, which should be a comprehensive corrections code, which unfortunately it is not. I also think consideration should be given to the adoption of a comprehensive code of evidence. I know that the Supreme Court now has under consideration a proposal to basically do that by rule. I have some substantial reservations about whether that's appropriate, whether a lot that would go into an evidence code is in fact substantive law, ought to be adopted by a legislature and not by a court through court rule. Those are in any event the general comments that I had, and I don't know what kind of time frame you're operating under. I do have specific observations about problem areas in the bill, and areas that I also think are of benefit. And if it's the pleasure of the committee, I'll proceed with that.
I don't know how long it is to have, Dan, but if you want to, you can submit those to the committee as any proposed amendments in a written testimony. If it's something brief, I think you could go ahead now, or if you want to cover some of the major points.
Okay, maybe that would be preferable, because there are a couple of major points that I think deserve a public airing.
Okay, Mr. Brown?
Well, Mr. Hickey, really what you've done, of course, is you've kind of reviewed, in a way, much of the kind of testimony we've had in the meetings that were other than the public hearings on this since we started getting the tentative drafts last year. But, so I'll just give you a couple of leading questions. If you know, when was the last time there was any kind of a comprehensive rewrite of the criminal law under which we now live?
I suppose that it'd be fair to say that the last time was at statehood. And at that time, an awful lot of the criminal law was simply reincorporated from the compiled laws of Alaska under territorial days, and if not, was lifted wholesale out of the Oregon Code, which in turn was lifted wholesale many years before out of a 1820 some, I think, Ohio Code.
Well, New York, as a matter of fact. Actually, as you know, it's a major interest of mine and has been for a lot of years. last time there was any kind of a comprehensive rewrite of the entire criminal code in the series of jurisdictions from which we got ours was not statehood, and it wasn't the 55th Congress in 1899. It wasn't even Oregon. It was New York in 1828, and that's how old our current criminal law and its total structure is. And most other jurisdictions have benefited from at least one other major revision since that time.
Senator Rohde?
Dan, I received a letter, as did many legislators, several months ago, noting some concerns from members of the bench, the Superior Court and District Court in Anchorage. Could you briefly capsulize some of the questions they had about the code?
Well, there were, of course, two judicial members of the subcommission, as you know. From the Superior Court, there was Judge Moody, who has been on the Superior Court for a number of years now, and prior to that was Attorney General of the state. From the District Court, there was Judge Laurel Peterson. Throughout the proceedings, and I don't want to attempt to represent whether Judge Moody's or Judge Peterson's views were representative of the judiciary as a whole, but throughout the proceedings of the subcommission, there was concern expressed by the judicial representatives that certain provisions in the code, in their judgment, were complicated, unnecessarily so, that they broke the code down or certain crimes down into an excessively complicated degree structure, that consideration should have been given to identifying only those areas that are problem areas and taking care of those areas. An example of that would be the current state of our law with respect to felony murder. As an attorney, I'm sure you know that we, in essence, do not have a felony murder rule in this state. If it's felony murder, it is already second-degree murder, and it simply elevates it to first degree. That unlike every other jurisdiction, felony murder in this state would require an intent to kill, or the proof of an intent to kill. Those were the kind of problems that in particular, Judge Moody, I think, thought should be emphasized and addressed, as opposed to a wholesale, comprehensive revision. I'm sure Chairman Gardner can add to that. I've talked, on the other hand, to other judges who express a contrary viewpoint. That the work they had examined at the point I talked to them, they thought was basically good, that it was moving in the right direction, that a comprehensive revision was in order. And I think that's basically where the issue split, is whether you did a piecemeal revision or dealing with identified problems, areas, or whether you did a wholesale revision of the code.
Just for everybody's information, tomorrow, Mr. Snowden is going to testify for the Alaska court system, so we'll have an official statement from the court system on the revision. Okay, Dan, if you wanted to cover some of your major points now,
Does everyone, I assume, have a copy of the bill? I think it'd be easy to draw your attention to.
I just also wanted to observe that Senator Bob Ziegler here with the committee now, Senate Judiciary Committee.
At the very beginning, on page 1, the third section of the bill, AS 1116-120, which sets out exemptions to criminal liability for conduct of another. In other words, situations where someone who could be held liable for conduct of another under a theory of, say, solicitation, conspiracy, accomplice liability, etc., would not be held liable in the on the next page under that section, subsection A3, you have a defense set out which a later section makes an affirmative defense that under circumstances manifesting a voluntary and complete renunciation of his criminal intent, he terminated his complicity before the commission of the offense and wholly deprived his complicity of its effectiveness in the commission of the offense, or gave timely warning to law enforcement authorities or otherwise made proper efforts to prevent the commission of the offense. My comment is a policy-level comment. I think the use of the word or there is inappropriate, and that in order for the affirmative defense to be available to a person, it should read in the conjunctive. It should be and. It's intentional. It was a disputed issue on the commission. And I feel rather strongly that it should be in. It raises, in my judgment, a rather significant potential loophole for complicity in certain kinds of criminal behavior. That's line eight. the or at the end of that line, I would propose changing to in hand.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Brown?
I know we are going to all be marking up things in our files, but may I assume that Mr. Stern will continue to keep running notes of comments of witnesses at these public hearings, the same that he has comments to members of the committee as we went through the draft?
We'll have a record of all the any proposed amendments by anybody that's testifying for the committee to review.
Proposed AS 1116130, dealing with the criminal liability of organizations on page 3, contains a, under subsection A1, an exclusion of some felony offenses. I'm not sure which ones, and I think that I simply want to draw that to the committee's attention and suggest that in their markup session they examine that, get some clarification of it. It would be lines 12 and 13 of page 3. You'd note that the liability of an organization would extend to violations and misdemeanors, but not necessarily to all felonies. And I, in my judgment, felony offenses are precisely what should be included as applicable to an organization. Page 7 of the bill, section 11-21-170, justification use of physical force by peace officer in making arrest or preventing an escape. Well, my comments on this section are I don't know how much time
I know.
Sounds
like you're doing an impression of the reporter.
Okay. Impression of Barry?
Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't want to do that.
Congratulations, Barry.
I might note for the record that Mr. Stern and I very seldom find ourselves in conflict on a matter. This section, I think, needs some attention. It's a bit confusing. You'll notice on line 14 there, there's it's the basic provision that would justify the use or threatened use of physical force when a peace officer reasonably believes it necessary to make an arrest, prevent escape from custody, or to make a lawful stop. There, if you compare back with your definition of deadly force near the end of the bill, physical force, there would seem to be an omission there in that physical force does not include, as presently drafted, deadly physical force, and I believe it should, and Mr. Stern and I have discussed this.
Yeah. Now, I understand. You know, there are two things in there. There's a reference to physical force on line 14, and then he says I'm using deadly physical force. Or does that address a different situation on line 18?
On line 18, yeah.
I think it does, and I think that that the reason there is an ambiguity is that if that's the case, if deadly physical force is subsumed in the definition of physical force, which I think is a matter of common understanding, it must be, then subsection C of the bill represents a potential problem. In that it indicates a peace officer is justified in using deadly physical force and making a lawful stop only when the use of deadly physical force is authorized under other sections of this chapter. Now, the section doesn't speak to threats of deadly physical force, and it's not clear to me at this time whether subsection C is consistent with subsection A, if in fact the definition of physical force as used in subsection A includes the term deadly physical force. Now, the reason this can become a problem is that, for example, one of probably the most potentially dangerous situations that a police officer faces, along with family disputes, which I think is a matter of common knowledge, is the traffic stop along the highway late at night. There's simply no way of reliably knowing whether the person you've just stopped for a taillight violation, for example, is someone who is fleeing the scene of a homicide. And there have been more than anyone would like to think, a number of recorded instances of police officers who have been killed in making such traffic stops and approaching vehicles with less than the kind of caution than would seem to be justified under the circumstances. I think that scenario needs to be taken into consideration, and we need to be very sure that we're not restricting the potential use or threatened use of force here in a way that is going to unjustifiably endanger police officers in the line of duty. And I raised the issue for that reason.
Probably needs to be clarified drafting, but the intent was to allow the threat to use deadly physical force to make a lawful stop.
That was my recollection and understanding of the intent.
And in the definition of physical force, the term, this that physical force includes deadly physical force was inadvertently admitted when the bill was typed up. But it was
it
just has to be redrafted.
It's in the tentative drafts that we have?
I don't know if it's in the tentative drafts or not, but I know that the issue came up during the subcommission's discussions, probably after the TDs were distributed, and was felt that we should specifically provide that physical force does include deadly physical force.
This issue gets to be an additional problem when you, for example, compare the language of that section with section 200 on page 9, which is the use of physical force in resisting or interfering with arrest. In lines 17 and 18, for example, it would provide for the ability to use that when the physical force used by the peace officer exceeds that allowed by section 170 of this chapter, which means that it's very important that that section 170 of this chapter be precise and correct, or you're going to be creating situations where citizens are going to assume that that they have some kind of a right that they don't or was not intended to use force to resist an arrest, which I think would be very undesirable. The next matter I want to raise is I think a difficult but a very necessary policy issue, I'd like to turn the committee's attention to page 12 of the bill, chapters 26 pertaining to responsibility. Section 1126.010 there restates what is now found in Title 12 dealing with the insanity defense. It states the standard that's to be adopted, which was adopted by this legislature in 1972, which represented a change from the McNaughton standard, which is the old common law right or wrong test, to the more modern ALI test, which is whether result of a mental disease or defect, an individual lacks the substantial capacity to conform his conduct to the requirements of the law. I have no quarrel with that standard. I think that's the appropriate standard. I think the legislature made a serious mistake in 1972, however, when it adopted the burden of proof that was placed on the state with respect to the insanity defense. As that section reads under existing law and as it would read under this proposed section, whenever an individual injects the defense of insanity into a case, and there's some evidence admitted that would support that defense, the burden then shifts to the state to demonstrate beyond a reasonable doubt that the person is not insane. In other words, to prove a negative. There is presently a case that is pending before the Supreme Court a second time around, which I'd like to briefly recite as an example, which I think represents the kind of problem which this present provision represents. An individual broke into a home, raped a woman, and then stabbed her repeatedly. He was tried and convicted for first-degree murder. He raised a defense of insanity, had a psychiatrist and a psychologist testify at trial. The judge ruled that insufficient evidence had been admitted establishing the defense of insanity to shift the burden of proof to the state beyond a reasonable doubt. In addition, the state relied
and we realize the limitations that then are imposed upon us by your classification scheme of only using three stages of felonies. Perhaps there could be subcategories. I know that Mr. Hickey yesterday suggested something he called A-plus felonies. Perhaps there could be B-minus felonies. I really don't know, but... murder, right, but... Right.
His comparison of an A-plus felony was to treat, I think, the highest degree of kidnapping as similarly to murder.
Was going to make another... It's for another degree.
Yeah.
Right. But what we were concerned about is we felt that the criteria that we arrived at certainly covered the risk and was able to assess which are the more serious of burglaries and which are the less serious. Whether or not that is compatible with your structure or the scheme of the bill is something that we didn't have a specific answer to and didn't address. We just felt that this more completely typified the risk and what societal concern is as to burglaries. We were also concerned about a specific drafting area of the forged instruments statute, 1146, 510 and 520 at page 70. Under the principal statute, I believe section 500, an intent to defraud is written in. However, under the two sections I've just referred you to, section 510 and 520, the intent to defraud is not written in as an element. And in a situation such as 510, a person commits the crime of criminal possession of a forged instrument if knowing it to be forged and with intent to utter it, he possesses a forged instrument. We felt that also intent to defraud should be written in there to protect people, certainly bank tellers and other people who have a forgery and then deliver it to someone else or even deliver it to the police under the definition of utter could be at least subjected to prosecution under this. We feel that intent to defraud would be a painless addition to this proposal and would clear up any ambiguities or any problems that might have. Under section 520, also, they indicate under, I believe, section 1, if you make or possess with knowledge of its character a plate, die, or other device, apparatus, equipment, or article specifically designed for use in counterfeiting or otherwise forging written instruments, you're guilty of that offense. I think, again, there can be people who properly have custody of those devices with no intent to defraud anyone, either working in a law enforcement capacity or in a personal capacity in which they've come across it and are delivering it to someone else, including their supervisor. We feel, again, that intent to defraud would not weaken the statute in any way as it's drafted, but would clarify that area so that intent was required, so that you would avoid causing innocent people to come within the scope of that statute. Relating to the unauthorized use of propelled vehicle statutes, commonly referred to as joyriding, section 1146, 240, subsection C, at page 61 of the bill, making a second offense a felony. Again, this was an area that the committee felt could be better addressed in sentencing rather than a substantive provision of the bill, and that certainly if a person came up for a second offense, that the first offense considerations and all other considerations would certainly be used to determine whether or not they had an intent to permanently deprive and might cause the person to be convicted of theft and a felony, but also it would be a very severe sentencing consideration and could be addressed in that area.
Chairman, may I ask a question?
Mr. Brown?
Relates to this. If I don't ask it now, I'm not going to remember to. It comes out of a conversation that Mr. Dankworth and I had with Chief Barclay after the last meeting about the same section. What about the situation where the a joyriding incident occurs? You can't prove intention to deprive. It's only, so it's only under current law and under this joyriding. But maybe you can show reckless behavior that results in actual substantial damage to the propelled vehicle. Now, is that covered by another provision of the code so that you'd be able to charge the person with a crime relating to that? That's a problem currently.
Yeah, you would be able to go under a criminal mischief, one of the degrees there, I believe.
But that's still at the misdemeanor level, right?
Well, I'll have to check that out. I can't give you 1 second. I know it's one way you could deal with joyriding is simply treated as a form of criminal mischief and eliminate the need for a separate statute. We have, it would be at least a B misdemeanor, and, no, that's right, it would be a B misdemeanor. If you wanted to treat it as a felony, you would simply have to, or an A misdemeanor, you would simply have to add another section in terms of recklessly causing damage and an amount exceeding,
I'd like to discuss that when you're marking it up. Some kind of a thing like that is maybe a middle ground between the position taken by the bar and the position taken by the bar by the police officers. This is our technical director, Representative Carpenter.
The final statute that our committee addressed and wants to bring to your attention today, although we did address minor drafting problems throughout the code and worked with the subcommission and have other minor matters that I could certainly forward to Mr. Stern and forward in writing to your committee, but the final statute of substance that we did address and took a position on was the prostitution statute, 1166, section 100 at page 112 of the bill. The committee approved of the overall differentiation of offenses as they currently stand, but took the position that the act itself, if not solicited in public, if not conducted in public, was not a subject to be criminalized. That solicitation itself should be punished as the code currently stands, and all other factors that the code lays out for punishment should be punished, but that the act itself, section 100, should not be subject to criminal prosecution. That was the final area we addressed. As I indicated earlier, we thoroughly reviewed 3 volumes of this code as it came out. Our review of the last 2 volumes and the one that's not out on sentencing has not been able to be completed because of time pressures and the publishing schedule of the code. We would like to address sentencing. We would like to address affirmative defenses very likely, and there may be other areas that we can submit in writing or at future hearings. These are areas that we either were not able to resolve through the subcommission or were areas that surfaced after the subcommission ceased meeting. A number of the areas that I've raised today were never presented to the subcommission simply because of the scheduling and the time problems, and it's because of that that I wanted to bring those specific areas to your attention. But we would be glad to meet further and submit further recommendations and further thoughts with you, and if there are going to be any future hearings, participate in those.
Any questions from the committee members? Mr. Brown.
Chairman, I don't know how well funded the bar is this year for their lobbying budget, but they do have a registered lobbyist here, and if you can communicate with him, he could be present during at least some of our markup on the House side. And I know the chairman intends to try to start Monday.
We have had difficulty in funding on this particular project. The Tanana Valley members have oftentimes been concerned as to whether or not they can get to Anchorage. We went to Fairbanks at one time, but the money has not been...